Hello, I'm Norman Swan and welcome to this week's Health Report. Today on the programme, we offer succour to the sore knee, we offer reduced worries to women undergoing IVF, we take a hard look at Xanax and persistently large variations in preventable hospital admissions in Australia, particularly looking at Queensland and Victoria. This is a report just released from the Grattan Institute in Melbourne. Stephen Duckett's the Health Programme Director and he joins us from the studio in Melbourne. Welcome, Stephen.
Good afternoon, Norman.
So this is about place. I mean, this is just describe the study to us, because these are extraordinary variations where some parts of Australia, particularly in Queensland and Victoria, 38 places in Queensland, 25 places in Victoria, have a 50% increased average hospitalizations that are preventable, and they've lasted for over a decade.
Yeah, so we got all of the hospital data for Queensland and Victoria, and we analysed, we decided there'd be a threshold of 50% worse than the state average. We used the list of so-called ambulatory care sensitive conditions or potentially preventable hospitalisations.
So these developed. Are ones that just ambulatory care is code for, they could be treated by your GP in the community.
That's right, yeah. That's right. And so we used the list that had been agreed by governments. And so we started by trying to identify those places which had high rates. What we found was that an area with a high rate in 1 year has a 50% chance of being not a high rate the next year.
Really?
So we were quite interested in the extent of persistence that we've got to actually see if something's going to have a place that's got a high rate for 3 years or more, it's likely to stay, whereas if it's only 1 year, it's not likely to stay high. So then we were even tougher and said, we're interested in those areas which have had high rates every year for a decade. And it surprised us, we found these places that have, that this is supposed to be potentially preventable hospitalisations where they're more than 50% above the state average every year for a decade.
So what sort of places are we talking about? Are they surprises?
Well, yes and no. We found places in metropolitan areas and in rural areas, remote areas. So some of the Aboriginal communities, Palm Island and so on, Aurukun, have got high rates. Lower socioeconomic status areas in the suburbs like Caboolture in Brisbane or Broadmeadows in Melbourne also have high rates. But what was quite interesting about this, we went in saying, oh, look, all the low socioeconomic status areas are going to have high rates of potentially preventable hospitalisations. But that turned out not to be the case. So in Melbourne...
So it wasn't just about poverty?
It wasn't just about poverty. So in Melbourne, Broadmeadows has got a high rate of potentially preventable hospitalisations every year for a decade. Sunshine never had a high rate of potentially preventable hospitalisations.
And Frankston, which is a bit richer, does too. So
yes. So yeah. It's quite mixed. There are individual... And we also looked at differences in patterns. So in some of these places, a small number of people who have high rates of readmission drive the problem. But in other places, it's not readmissions at all, even though many of these are chronic diseases. So it's a very localised issue and quite different in different parts of Australia.
And what sort of conditions are we talking about here?
So the standard sort of list of chronic diseases, angina, diabetes, asthma, but also some acute conditions like dental care, admissions for dental care are also in our list.
And extraordinary variations in dental care.
Well, it's quite extraordinary. So generally, in fact, if you look again at Melbourne, in metropolitan Melbourne, none of the postcodes had high rates of admissions for dental care. But in parts of rural Victoria, there are places which two or three times the state average. So Colac, for example, not a poor area, Mildura have more than twice the state average rate of admission for dental care.
So presumably for extractions.
Extractions, gum disease possibly, and it's probably because neither of those places have had fluoride for very long. They basically fluoridated in 2010 in both of those cases, and so the community didn't have the public health intervention that they should have had in terms of fluoride in the water supply.
So that's one cause. You call these hot spots and maintained heat in many ways over a 10-year period. What are the other factors that differentiate an area that looks very similar on paper yet doesn't have this unacceptably high unnecessary hospitalisation rate?
Well, all we can analyse is the outcome, that is the hospitalisation, and occasionally we can look at the readmission. Well, we can look at the readmissions and so on, but we actually don't know whether it's because there's just no primary care there or very poor primary care access, or because the primary care is there and is good, but the disease burden is so high. We tried to look at the access to primary care.
So this is general practice.
Yeah, we asked for Medicare data to enable us to look at age, sex, standardised rates of admission by geographic area, but we weren't allowed access to those data, so we couldn't actually look at the...
I thought the Commonwealth had this new policy that data were open to all with the aim of better health through data.
That's our hope too, Norman, but we were given data with age and sex in it, and we're given data with geography in it, but not near the twain should meet, so we couldn't do standardised
rates. So the new era of open data has not quite arrived.
Not quite in time for our study.
So given you don't know what the causes are, how do you know what the solutions are?
So what we're saying is the action has to be at the local level, and the new organisations that have been created with Commonwealth funding, the primary healthcare networks, in our view, or they're required by the Commonwealth to set priorities about what they should be doing. And we're suggesting that those organisations need to set priorities for these places which have had such disadvantage for 10 years in a row. They should be investigating what is it that's in the local community, what is it that's not there, what is it that's causing these, that's driving these admissions, and they should be developing local action. And also, we should be evaluating that. There should be a national evaluation of what's happening in these places, because we've got to learn from each place to another place, because the intervention strategies, what needs to be done, isn't well known, and we don't have a good evidence base for that.
And given it's place-based, it's going to be different for different communities.
Yes, there may be some commonality. So, you know, these are chronic diseases. And so you might say, well, do they have in place self-management programs to teach people how to manage their own chronic disease better?
And does that make a difference?
And does that make a difference? Well, the evidence is it sort of does, but we actually haven't tried that. We haven't evaluated in the various, does it work in an Aboriginal community? Does it work in a suburban Melbourne or suburban Brisbane and so on?
Well, we watch with interest. Stephen Duckett, thanks for joining us on the Health Report.
Thanks, Norman.
Professor Stephen Duckett, who's Health Program Director at the Grattan Institute, and that report's available on their website. And you're listening to the Health Report here on Radio National, ABC News Radio, and CBC Radio in Canada. Welcome to all our Canadian listeners. For many years now, there's been fears and conflicting evidence that in vitro fertilisation might increase the risk of breast cancer in women undergoing the procedure. Now, a large 20-year study has come up with what many hope are definitive answers. One of the authors of the study is Alexander van den Belt-Dusebout, and she's in the Department of Epidemiology at the Netherlands Cancer Institute, and she joins me on the line from Holland. Welcome to the Health Report, Alexandra.
Hello, good morning.
Why might IVF cause breast cancer?
Female sex hormone levels increase during in vitro fertilization, during the ovarian stimulation that is necessary for retrieving eggs. And sex hormone levels have been known to increase the risk of breast cancer.
So you're not using estrogen to stimulate the ovaries, but they use hormones that stimulate the ovaries, and then the ovaries produce estrogen, and then that drives the breasts. That's the theory.
Yes, exactly.
And what evidence before your study was there that there might be a risk?
There had been many studies, but the drawback was that the studies were limited in numbers of breast cancer, and the follow-up was too short to be sure what would be the risk in long term.
And I mean, it's not just increased hormone levels. When you do IVF, you also decrease the hormone levels, don't you, to actually take control of the menstrual cycle?
Yes, that's true. First, the cycle, first the levels are decreased, and after that, the ovarian stimulation takes place and the levels increase.
So what do you do? What did you do in this study?
We had 25,000 women that had been treated for subfertility problems, 19,000 IVF-treated women in the period 1983 to 1995, and also 6,000 women who received other subfertility treatments in roughly the same period.
So you're comparing So you're comparing IVF, but you're also comparing women with infertility per se to see whether infertility itself had an influence on breast cancer.
Yes, exactly. We followed all these women through December 2013. That was a median follow-up of 21 years. And we compared both groups with the general population in the Netherlands. And we compared the IVF group with the non-IVF group.
And what did you find?
We found that the risk was not increased, neither compared with the general population or with the non-IVF group, not even when the follow-up was more than 20 years. And there was also not a difference for the different types of treatment or different types of subfertility diagnosis.
On reading your paper, it looked as though the more IVF cycles, I mean, you don't want a woman to have unnecessary IVF cycles, but the more IVF cycles a woman had, the less likely she was to develop breast cancer. What's going on there?
Yes, women who received more than 6 cycles of IVF and also women who had a low egg yield at the first IVF cycle had a decreased risk. That can be explained because those women tend to reach menopause at an earlier age. And an earlier age of menopause protects or decreases the risk of breast cancer.
Which is also a story about estrogen stimulation, because the more menstrual cycles you have, the more estrogen stimulation you have, and therefore later onset of menstruation in your life and earlier cessation of menstruation decreases the risk of breast cancer. So that was nothing to do with IVF. That was simply a phenomenon of those women who were reaching the end of their fertile life a bit earlier than you might have expected.
Yes, exactly. And that was exactly the reason, probably the reason that they had to go for IVF to still have a pregnancy.
Now, ovarian stimulation isn't quite so aggressive these days, but presumably it doesn't. That's not the reason. It's presumably to improve outcomes. Although these studies are not cause and effect, they're associations, because you're just looking at the relationship between factors over time. Can you be confident in saying to women now, look, it really doesn't look likely that breast cancer is a risk of IVF?
Yes, we can. These results are quite reassuring for women who have been treated with IVF in the past. And since the treatments have been quite similar in the different Western countries, we also have confidence that the results are applicable to other Western countries.
What about other female cancers, such as cancer of the uterus, endometrial cancer, or ovarian cancer?
Yes. In our study, we are also looking into the risks of other hormone-related cancers. And we recently did analyses on melanoma and colorectal cancer, and we didn't find increased risks either. And we are also in the future investigating the risks of endometrial cancer and ovarian cancer. And we will do that in an even larger cohort, because we recently also included women who have been treated in the period 1995 to 2000. So then we have more than 40,000 women in the cohort.
So, cause for, we'll do, and we'll just follow that up and hopefully speak to you when you've got some results there before we set any panic afoot. Look, thank you very much for joining us, Alexandra.
Okay. Thank you.
Alexandra van den Belt-Dusebout, who's in the Department of Epidemiology at the Netherlands Cancer Institute. And as I say, you're listening to The Health Report here on Radio National, CBC Radio and ABC News Radio. For a long time, there's been an ongoing controversy when you're middle-aged and have a torn knee cartilage, or whether it's worth doing an arthroscopy, which is telescope surgery, minimal invasive surgery to actually trim the cartilage. You might have seen my Four Corners recently, which in September, which actually dealt with partly this. It was more arthritis than torn meniscus or a torn cartilage. And it's been a fascinating study in the British Medical Journal of comparing exercise therapy to arthroscopy for people who've had a meniscal tear or a torn cartilage. And on the line from Martina Hansens Hospital in Norway is orthopaedic surgeon Dr. Nina Kais. Welcome to the Health Report.
Hello. Hello to you.
Tell me about this study.
Oh, this study. Yes, we had 140 patients, and half of them has gone through arthroscopic partial meniscectomy, and the other half has gone through exercise therapy. All patients have had degenerative meniscal tears in their meniscus and had the pain in the joint line, and we took x-rays at baseline, and only 4% of them had osteoarthritis evaluated by x-rays. So there has been some studies earlier comparing these patients doing exercise therapy or exercise therapy in addition to surgery. And the conclusion has been that surgery has no additional effect in these patients.
So let's just double back for a moment, because you've given away the punchline very early, Nina, but thank you very much for doing that. So what I covered, in fact, recently was arthritis. So if you've got arthritis and your knee surgeon says, look, I'm going to clean it out with arthroscopy, there's no advantage to that versus dummy...
No, it's not. No, not in the long term.
So when somebody has... some people say that a torn cartilage is in fact a normal phenomenon of aging, but the people that you looked at, and whether or not you've got symptoms or not, but the people that you looked at actually had symptoms.
Yes, they had symptoms. They had pain in the knee. That's why they went to their doctors saying they had pain in the knee, and then they were examined by MRI, and they saw that it was a degenerative meniscal tear. And it has been practiced the last 20, 30 years to do arthroscopy on these patients and removing meniscal tissue.
So just doing a clean-up of the torn meniscus. And this was in 50-year-olds that you did this. So this is not young people with a sports tear. This is older people. And tell me about the exercise program that they went through as a comparison.
The exercise program consisted of warming up exercises, strengthening exercises, and neuromuscular exercises for balance.
So the strengthening exercises presumably are to your quads, the muscles on the front of your knee.
Yes, and the back, the hamstrings.
And the neuromuscular ones, what do they do?
They were standing at Busu balls. Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
Doing knee bends and
So functional improving. And you're getting eccentric stimulation on that. And so when you compared the two at the end of the 12-week course, there was no difference in any symptoms.
No, it was not. Not after 2 years. What is the main outcome of this study?
But did they both get improvement?
The exercise group improved in muscle strength at 3 months and 12 months.
Did they both improve with pain?
Yes, they did.
Now you allowed people after they'd been in the exercise group to cross over. If they were unhappy, they could go off and have knee surgery. They could often have knee arthroscopy, and 1 in 5 of them did. What happened to them?
Yes, they were at a 2 year of follow up. They were exactly like the other patients, so they did not lose anything by going through exercise therapy first.
And the other way of looking at that is they didn't gain anything by having the extra surgery either.
No, they didn't actually.
So if I'm right, Nina, you are an orthopaedic surgeon.
Yes.
So are your colleagues talking to you anymore?
Yes, they do.
So, I mean, they don't feel that you've undermined the knee surgery market in Norway?
No, not at all. There has been a slow decrease in arthroscopy for these patients the last 2 years in Norway, as also seen in Denmark and Sweden. And that, I think that is a result of the RCTs that has been published the last years. Mentioned earlier, and also the one from Finland by Sivon, who compared arthroscopy with meniscal resection with sham surgery, and no difference at 1 year in pain in the patients.
So no doubt the physiotherapists or physical therapists and exercise physiologists are rejoicing at your study, but what you didn't do was do nothing. Have you got any sense of you've got a meniscal tear, you've got a bit of pain, well, why bother doing anything? Do you know what the results are if you do nothing?
No, I'm sorry for that. I don't do that. So that's a weakness of our study, that we had no group without treatment at all. But that's the plan for me further on now, to look on patients coming to our hospital, and I will follow them and take them back after 2 or 5 years to see how they come on if they have not done the exercise therapy, because most patients think it's hard to fulfill the exercise therapy program. So if they are not in a study, I think many patients not do all the exercises we suppose they are doing. So I'll try to look into that.
So not content with destroying the orthopedic industry in Norway, you're going to go after the physiotherapists and exercise physiologists. I'm glad to hear it. But no doubt the accountants in the Norwegian Department of Health are delighted with you. Look, Nina Kais, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a delight talking to you, and it's been fascinating for... we don't have a very middle-aged audience. They're very young, but I'm sure for one day when they are 50 years old, they'll be absolutely fascinated to know that information. Thank you very much indeed.
Yes, thank you.
Nina Kais is an orthopaedic surgeon at Martina Hansens Hospital in Sandvik in Norway. Listening to the Health Report here on RN. Now, there's a drug, an anti-anxiety drug around called Xanax. Many of you have heard about it. It's actually quite toxic. And the government realised that it was fairly toxic, lots of calls to the poison centre, and they rescheduled it. And there's been a study done at the University of New South Wales, with colleagues at the University of Sydney, looking at what the effect of rescheduling those drugs are, because how do you actually change the way drugs are prescribed and influenced, and can regulation actually have an influence? And the person doing that study, along with her colleagues, is Andrea Schaefer, who's in the unit of big data research in health at the University of New South Wales. Welcome to the Health Report.
Thank you very much, Norman.
Big data research in health. Just tell us about your unit before we get on to the subject of Xanax.
Well, we primarily do a research that uses data that has been collected for reasons other than research purposes, so administrative data. Like, for example, in the study that we did, we used pharmaceutical benefit scheme data on pharmacy claims that have been dispensed at chemists, and hospitalization data collected at the state level, as well as emergency department data, Medicare benefits scheme data as well.
So we heard from you. You've been sitting listening to the program while it's been going to air, and you heard Stephen Duckett at the beginning complaining that he wasn't getting open data from the Commonwealth.
Yes.
Did you?
It can. Sorry.
Because the Commonwealth is boasting about how the fact they're making all their data available. But
yes, I think there's something coming up in the pipeline, but at the moment you do have to go through a few hoops to get access to data.
Right. And sometimes when you talk about big data in health, people are using other data that are not in health at all, like supermarket data or people's shopping habits and things like that. Do you use that in your research too?
Or? I'm not aware of anyone in our group who uses that sort of data, no, at this stage. It's mostly health data.
So let's talk about Xanax. What's the problem with Xanax? So the actual proper name for it is alprazolam.
It is, yes. Alprazolam, when it's compared to other benzodiazepines...
It's used for anxiety and panic
anxiety
disorder.
Anxiety and insomnia as well, although in Australia it's only PBS listed for the treatment of panic disorder. Compared to other benzodiazepines, alprazolam, it's more toxic, and as well it's more commonly abused. And its use had been increasing in Australia, and so that was concerning, and that is why the TGA decided to reschedule it.
And what was the toxicity?
When individuals might overdose on a benzodiazepine, if they're taking alprazolam, they're more likely to die or have worse outcomes than if they overdose on, say, diazepam or oxazepam.
And was it being abused as well?
Yes, it's commonly abused, particularly by people who abuse opioids, for example, heroin, and patients who overdose on illicit drugs, they're often also abusing alprazolam.
So if you're on alprazolam and you're on, say, heroin, that could increase your risk of dying of an overdose simply because of the two drugs working together.
Yes, and in comparison to, say, other benzodiazepines.
So when they rescheduled, what did they actually do?
Well, in Australia, all medicines are classified into a schedule, and the majority of medicines that are prescribed, such as statins or blood pressure medicines, they're classified as Schedule 4. Medicines
which
that
means
have,
the GP can just write an ordinary script for them.
Exactly. Medicines that have a high potential for abuse or addiction, they're classified as Schedule 8, and those are called controlled drugs. And
so morphine-like drugs would be on Schedule 8.
Exactly, yes. And so what that means is that those medicines, they can still be prescribed, but they're just subject to additional restrictions and controls.
Such as?
The restrictions vary by state, but includes things like getting a permit from a state authority to prescribe, requiring that the GP handwrite the prescription, and having the prescriptions expire after 6 months rather than a year.
So it just becomes much more difficult.
It does, yes.
And what did you do in this study?
Well, we had access to...
I mean, is there any doubt that rescheduling changes prescribing habits? I mean, it would make sense that it does.
Yeah, that's what you'd expect. And but the issue is, not only does it reduce prescribing of alprazolam, but we also want to look at whether there's any unintended consequences, either positive or negative. For example, if alprazolam is more difficult to get, are people switching to other less appropriate drugs, or are they switching to more appropriate alternatives?
Given that the evidence base for these drugs treating anxiety disorder is pretty poor in the first place.
Yes.
What did you find?
Well, we found that almost immediately after the rescheduling, the prescribing of alprazolam dropped by 22%. We also looked at...
And there were a lot of prescriptions, like 18,000 or something like that.
Yes, we had over our study period, which was 6 years.
It's over 6 years rather
than there was 18,000 people in our sample. So this is a 10% sample of all prescribed alprazolam in Australia. And that was 18,000 people over 6 years.
So it's still quite a large number if it's a 10% sample.
Yes, yeah. So the prescribing dropped by 22%. We also found that there was increases in the use of other less toxic benzodiazepines, particularly oxazepam and diazepam.
Diazepam, which the common trade name is Valium.
Yes.
So there was a trade-off. Was it a one-to-one trade-off, or did the overall rate of prescribing of benzodiazepines, which is actually what you'd want, you'd want that to go down, did it overall go down, or was it a one-to-one trade-off?
It's a bit difficult to compare. One of the issues is alprazolam, well, all medicines can be prescribed and dispensed privately as well as through the PBS. And we only had access to PBS prescriptions.
So the GPs might have reverted to private prescriptions.
Or it could be also...
But it was still Schedule 8, so you still got rules about the private prescription.
Exactly, yeah. So we suspect that the private market would have acted similarly to the PBS market, but you may have people switching from the private alprazolam market into the PBS diazepam market, for example.
And calls to the poison center halved.
Yep, they did. So over 12 months after the rescheduling, they dropped by 50%. And probably most importantly, we didn't see any increases in calls for poisonings associated with other benzodiazepines or sedatives.
So although you could go into a moral contortion about them trading off for other benzodiazepines, overall it was actually safer, even though it might not be more effective for
them. Yeah, so we didn't identify any increases in adverse outcomes. Given the data that we had and the outcomes that we could measure, we didn't see any negative consequences.
So in this case, rescheduling worked?
It appears so, yes.
Andrea Schaefer, thank you. Andrea Schaefer is a biostatistician at the Centre for Big Data Research and Health at the University of New South Wales. You've been listening to The Health Report. I'm Norman Swan, and I'll see you next week.